Larry, we're back, we're back, we're back, we're back, and I'm so happy to see you. You were almost late today, buddy.
I'll be there. I'm here.
Well, you're here. You know, you, one way or another, you always make it. You know, it bothers me. It does bother me because, you know, you're supposed to be, you know, when you play like you're Johnny Carson or somebody, I'm supposed to be Johnny Carson. What's the deal with that?
Uh-huh. Right, Eddie Mac. Uh-huh. You're Eddie Mac. You got the audience
you're,
ready.
You're Ed McMahon, okay? Right. Right, have another drink, you know what I'm saying? Let's go. Unbelievable. Hey, number one, it's so good to be here today. We have a very special show. Okay.
Don't we always?
Well, let me just say that I'm so excited to have a fellow Yankee mate of mine, the wonderful, intelligent, handsome Dana Cavalier, our strength and fitness coach. Here we go. And I want to talk about a little bit about why has it been since 2009 that the Yankees haven't been world champions, but yet when they were world champions, he was the guy. So I'm gonna hit him up a little bit on that. I'm gonna see if he comes to us with it.
Let me segue in, because they don't have a strength and conditioning coach anymore. Is that maybe the reason?
They do have a strength.
Not as good.
Well, they actually have a couple. Okay.
Oh, they needed two to replace him.
We'll talk about that. Okay. We'll put him on the spot.
All right.
And then we have a guy, you know, one of my favorite writers, scribes, the Dick Young of this era. You know, he's going to get mad when I say that. But that's okay. Jim Baumbach from Newsday. So
it's Baumbach Ideas? Because I think I remember it was Dick Young Ideas. So it's Baumbach Ideas.
Baumbach Ideas. He's bound by the back. You know what I mean? And then we have a terrific actor. He played... Well, you know, the guy that's been in the news the last couple of days is Reggie Jackson.
What else is new?
Okay. And he's talking about Manny Machado and all that kind of stuff. We did the play. You played George Steinbrenner. We put a couple of pounds on you. You were terrific. I'll give you that. But the guy that got rave reviews was Tyrell Carpenter, who played Reggie Jackson. So I'm excited about talking to him, and we're going to see what happens. You know, what's he got to say? I mean, he had big shoes to fill.
He had big shoes, but man, really, he got rave reviews. He deserved rave reviews.
Yes.
He was on point. He was great. You know, and I love the backstage stuff. You know, and I'm watching him backstage because I was watching everybody, and he was just in the moment. And I'll tell you another thing I loved about him. He really was such a great, I don't know if you say it on Broadway, a teammate. He was back there going to me, going, bro, you're good, be positive, be strong, and going to other people and doing that backstage. You don't know that because you were our front man. Johnny Carson, you were in the front.
Okay.
We were in the back. And he really was great in the front and helping everybody in the back.
Well, I'm excited to talk to him. He's such a good person. And first off, you've been busy. You've been running like a mad dog all over the place. I know you were with every celebrity in town lately, but most of it is for goodwill. I mean, tell us a little bit.
Listen, it's always about helping people. I mean, I'm not you. There's no doubt about that. There's only a few people out there like you. But I'm always trying to help out different charities. Listen, it's the truth, man. People look you up. It's never really about you. You're not one of those who always looks in the mirror. And the rest of us look in the mirror. You're not looking in the mirror. So a couple of things I'm working on. You know, the John Thiessen Children's Foundation, which really touches your heart. You know, John is doing it over 25 years.
Right.
He had a problem. He had a brain tumor. They saved him. And he was just in the hospital looking at all these other kids going, you know, who helps them? Who brings them gifts? Who brings them toys? Started his foundation. And the other night, I was at a pretty famous place here in Long Island called Mulcahy's.
Right.
And that's in Wantagh, up at a train station. And John Murray, another great guy, he's got to be in business over 30 years. You know, and no disrespect, because business is tough. Bars, restaurants, all businesses go in and go out, and John, over 30 years later, is still there. And John Thiessen has always brought his events there. And if we went to John and asked for help, he's not helping us. He's only helping children. So every event that I do help him with, and I'm on the microphone with him, and I'm on the stage, I got to tell you, Negroni, I cry. I mean, I can't hold it in. You know, these kids is just so sad, and he helps them. So on December 6th at Mulcahy's, we're doing an event, and each year I'll bring different celebrities for him. This year we're bringing Otis Anderson, okay. You know, 1990 Super Bowl MVP of the New York Giants, 10,000-yard rusher, Hall of Famer. People look at him as a Giant, but they forget that his career really was with the St. Louis Cardinals. Right. And then also bringing back, and because we're doing a thing about the 80s, even though it was 90 when he won, but it really was the 89 season. Mm-hmm. We're bringing back probably Negroni, I think arguably top five play in World Series history, arguably maybe top five play in baseball history. The famous Vin Scully call, the ball goes through Buckner's legs. I'm bringing Bill Buckner and Mookie Wilson on December 6th to his event.
That's going
to
be exciting.
Exciting, yeah. I mean, well, Billy Buckner, you think about a Negroni, guy had like 2,600 hits. I mean, the guy was a baller and gets no respect from people because of the play.
One play.
Because of one play.
One play.
Right.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, you listen, let's get on with our guest right now. A guy that I want to, I don't know if I want to beat him up or hug him, depending on what his answers are, but Jim Baumbeck, how are you, my brother?
I'm doing great. How about you, Ray?
You looking well?
The only regret I have here is that I didn't walk out of a door, you know, through a cape and all that, you know, through the curtain.
The next show, we're going to start with that. We're going to have a studio audience. We're going to keep you in the green room, and then all of a sudden we're going to have our backstage guys say, okay, Mr. Baumbeck, it's time. Could you please put your drink down? Yes. Thank you. And walk you out, and then we're going to be able to say, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Baumbeck.
And not that he needs it, but we'd have a makeup person back there too, right? Because I always have the makeup.
Yeah, I was on a red-eye flight last night, so if there's bags
he
here.
He took a red-eye to get here, just so you know.
Really?
Okay.
To do this show? Wow.
At his expense. At his expense.
And I was not the best guest you can get on that red-eye flight, because in the first row of my red-eye flight was Charlie Jeter.
No kidding.
Yep. We love her. Love her. We saw her at the playoff game.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
I saw her, met her son. Yeah.
She watches the show, by the way. Hi, Charlie. He mentioned your name. We didn't tell him to say it. Hi.
Okay. That wasn't a plug.
Right.
So where were you coming
from? Turn two.
Business or just hanging out?
I was from Napa, Napa, California. She was there too.
Rich guy.
Yeah, he's a drinker.
I think we were both drinking wine, but not at the same place, because she was at, what I can gather, you know, CC Sabathia's wedding vow renewal apparently was this weekend.
Oh, really?
So there was a big crew there.
So he was out there.
Yeah.
Wow.
I would think CC's got to be there if it's his wedding, you know, unless he doesn't want to stay married, Negroni. I mean, maybe that's how you would do it, but.
Yeah, I don't know. Let me keep out of that one.
Yeah, really.
Okay.
But yeah, no. But Charlie was there on the flight. She was in the first row. I think I was 14, so I think I did okay.
Did she see you? Did you say hello?
You know what? The only reason I saw her, and it was a rare, I'm standing. You know, it's 11 o'clock at night. You're waiting for the red eye. I'm there with my wife and two friends, and they say, so and so to the, to the desk, and you don't listen to the name. It's not your name, you know. So then, they say it a couple times, and my friend says, does Derek Jeter have a sister? And I'm like, yeah, Charlie. And he's like, well, they're calling for Charlie Jeter. They go to front, by the time I see that, there she is at the front. And I've seen her at Yankee events before, but, at that point I was boarding. So.
You know, that's because she was getting a free upgrade.
Yeah.
Okay.
As she should. Yeah. She's Charlie Jeter.
All the money they got?
Well, listen, she's done a tremendous job running the Turn 2 Foundation.
She
deserves it. She really, really, that's a great foundation.
I'm not saying she deserves the upgrade.
You know, CC's wife has a foundation too, CC Candy. That's another great one where we're going to say because of the Yankee and the celebrity, they get a lot of stuff, but they use it the right way to make their charities great.
CC has the kitchen. Good.
Yes,
will say this though, my one condition for coming on the show, and I even tell Ray this. This was like where I said, okay, in my head, I'll agree to this, but this is my one condition, and I'm not even going to tell him.
Here we go.
But I gotta just talk about Ray Negron's stories. Like these are my favorite stories.
Here we go.
So my.
What are you looking to get back on? Is that
don't say anything yet. Because this weekend, I have been working really vigorously, and I really wanted you on here because, number one, I know you had a Hall of Fame vote.
I do.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
And I'm I know that you're not voting in this one particular guy who's very near and dear to my heart, as you well know, which is George Steinbrenner. Does he have a shot?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, I thought, what was he up, 4 years ago, I think it
yes.
was? You know, it's such a limited pool of people who vote for it. It's something like 12 16. Or 16. So he needs to get 12 of the 16 yeah. votes.
Yeah.
It's tough. You know,
I know one vote that he's got, which is Robbie Alomar's vote, because Robbie's always been a big, big fan of his. So I know he's voting for him. So that's one.
And if I recall correctly, they don't tell you. If he doesn't get enough, they don't tell you what the number he got.
So right.
You don't know if he got 11 or whatever.
Right.
You know, obviously he's a Hall of Famer. You know, obviously the impact he had.
Then why? What's taken so long?
It's, you know, there's 16 people to ask. I mean, that's...
Let's take a step back, okay? Because how one do you become like you are to get the opportunity to be... Sure. A voter, and that's my first question. And then my second question is, you guys are sitting here, and again, I don't know all this. So you're saying, second part would be 16 people get to vote on this, and one he's saying is Robbie Alomar, and I'm sitting there go, why is Robbie Alomar on this? So first tell us how you get to be there, and then please tell us how that's possible.
So there's two different votes. So I'm in the writers' section of the vote. So the players that are up this year, Mariano's up, he's obviously going to get in this year. Pettit's in. We'll see what happens with him. I'm the one who would vote for that. I have my own feelings on that. Actually, I get a ballot, and every year I frame it and I give it out as a gift. Like I don't send it back. It doesn't count as a vote because I'm not sending it back. My personal feeling is that I'm a reporter. My job is not to make the news. And if I'm deciding who's going to be in the Hall of Fame, I'm making news. I didn't get in this to make news. So I don't agree with the system. So I love getting a vote. I sign up to get it every year because I love. It's a nice Christmas gift to give out, you know, as long as they don't mail it in. But so anyway, that's my feeling. So how do I get that vote? You have to be a baseball writer with a baseball writer card for 10 years straight. And then once you get that and once you're on, you have your vote. Not for life, it's for a period of time. And you vote for the players who, after they are 5 years out of the game, then they're up on the ballot and they have to receive whatever percentage of vote to stay on the ballot, 75% to get in. Steinbrenner's on a completely different wing of this. He's on, like, I guess, and they
veterans. Change
it. Yeah, the Veterans Committee. It's the modern day, basically, version of what the Veterans Committee is. And it's essentially people like the writers would only be voting on baseball players. Here, it's people who maybe the writers overlooked, or maybe it's people who impacted the game in other ways. Bud Selig got in last time this way. Other owners go in this way. You know, maybe they'll look at Dana for his work on the 2009 Yankees team. You know, maybe the Veterans
Good point.
Committee.
Yes.
So it basically it's contributors to the game. I mean that you know. So that's how that works. And it's
who gets that vote though? Who is on the? Who are those 16 people?
And they change every 4 years.
Right.
So the 16 people who are voting on Steinbrenner this year are different than the 16 people who voted on last year.
Right.
So basically, it's not like it's well, he didn't get in last time. Why would he not? Why would he get in this time?
Right.
But we'll see. It's 16 to get 12 of 16 is tough, especially because it's their club and they.
But it shouldn't be tough for him. And I'm not being partial. He works for the Yankees. He's going to be partial. And plus, the guy was like a father to him. So I get that whole thing. Of course, he's always going to want him in there. But for what he did for this game, okay, forget about the Spiro thing. I mean, that was 30 years ago, and who cares anymore? I mean, that was like nothing, okay? Everything else the man has done has been all about people, always doing things for people, and for the game. And then when we talk about what sports is today, it's not a game anymore. Every sport is a business, and it just happens to be what they're selling is a game. So he created all of this money for every sport. It's just not what he did for the baseball owners, players, and everyone else. It's every sport. I mean, look at football with these numbers. I mean, every team is worth $1 billion. So that's what I don't get, what these people have against George Steinbrenner.
Yeah, I think baseball, the structure of baseball, the culture of baseball is... a very old culture in the sense that they look at one big sin and that suddenly covers up everything. I mean, look at the steroid users. I mean, or HGA. I mean, that's something that's stuck with them. I mean, you know, people argue all the time. Barry Bonds, you know, should he be in there? You know, at what point does he start? You know, anyway, my point is that maybe people look at Steinbrenner and say, you know, he had a life before the Spiro stuff. He had a life after that where he did, obviously before that, played a big role in The Money. And obviously after that, became a humanitarian in some, in many ways, that we learned about that he was before that too. Obviously Ray can speak to that. But we didn't really learn about that until the 90s, until they started winning. And all of a sudden the pressure was off this idea that he was firing people left and right. You know, it's, I always look at it on, and I, again, I'm not voting, I choose not to vote, but I always look at it on impact on the game. And, you know, how do you argue against that?
Right, and then you look at it, and then we'll get to Negroni, I'm sure he has some questions. You brought up Bud Selig. Yeah, Bud's in there overlooking the whole steroid thing because he looked at it from a business point of view and said, home runs, this is going to get us a lot of money and a lot of business, and that's what Bud did. Bud turned a blind eye to what was going on, and it created a huge, huge money stream for Major League Baseball.
Yeah, no, it's
and he's in.
Well, All I can say is I'm hoping, because for me, if George Steinbrenner gets into the Hall of Fame, it's a whole series of new questions from the younger people who's going to say, why is he in? What did he do? And then you're going to hear. You're going to hear the negative.
The greatness.
But you're also going to hear the greatness too. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And you, anybody that's in the Hall of Fame, they're not Father Flanagan. Okay? Some of these guys are real scandalous dudes, but yet they're in there. So I mean, let's stop it already, you know. But anyway, with that being said, I mean, we're going to be going back and forth. The one thing that I also want to say is that Dana Cavalier is here. Dana's got a new book, okay? Habit of a Champion. Why did you decide to do this book, and why didn't you do it when you were working for the New York Yankees? You were the last trainer or health and fitness guy that was there when the Yankees were world champions. You were the guy. You were the only guy. Now they got like three guys. Yeah, why didn't you do it then?
We weren't supposed to write books when we were there.
Okay.
I had a singular focus, get the guys ready, train them, and play to win. So really, writing a book wasn't on my mind at that point. You know, I had a lot more to focus on. I had my hands full, if you will, with you know, some of the players that I had to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So you know, again, writing a book just wasn't a part of my plan. I was busy watching you write books.
Well, let me just say this, and thank you. But look, you were training these guys. They were winning championships. They won a big championship. How much pressure was that on you?
Listen, I always say I was an asset manager for the Steinbrenner family, right? I had $300 million in human capital that I had to manage correctly and make sure that that capital was ready to be deployed each day at 7:05. And that's really was my responsibility. So it was pressure, but you didn't think about it as pressure because, you know, you had your routine that you executed day in and day out. You matched that routine up with the player's routine. And together, you know, we created a winning formula.
So every time a player got hurt under your watch,
right,
how difficult was that?
Sick. It's sickening, you know, because again, you're training these guys, you're in the trenches with them, you're trying to make them bulletproof and put armor all over them. And you know, listen, sometimes injuries do happen. You know, it could come from hydration status, it could come from temperature, it could come from just being a little bit fatigued that day, or maybe we flew in the night before and you know, we were in a seat, you know, all locked up. But there's so many factors that contribute to an injury. But when it went happened and it went down, you just don't feel good about it because of the time you put into.
I've been with the Yankees 45 years. I know how it works. Who gave you the worst beating from the standpoint of a player went down? They got to point the finger at somebody. So it's got to be you. Now, when that happened, how bad was it?
Jeez. Well, listen, you know, at the end of the day, I know Jim's here, but you really just wanted to keep it out of the papers because the fans would be the ones that would lash you the most. And
right.
And usually they'd find out about it, obviously, on TV, and then they'd read about it the next day, and they'd say, again, another injury? It must be the strength guy, you know?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that. It's so unfair.
And guys like me, I don't have anyone else to blame, so I just have to take the hit.
Well, you were working by yourself.
I was working solo. I liked it that way, though.
But were you ever pressured into, like, hey, add another guy because we have this guy, that guy? How do you, you know?
Yeah, you know, later in my career, the needs of the player started to expand. Everybody wanted more and more individualized attention. So later, guys wanted more. So we did the best we could, myself and Steve Donahue and Mark Littlefield, to really spread out the load. But, you know, to have an extra hand on deck is a blessing and a curse. You know, I knew what everybody needed. I knew how they felt. There was no other lines of communication opening up. It was just direct. Dana to player, player to me.
Every time that a player got hurt under your watch, did you ever feel like these guys, they're millionaires, multimillionaires, some of them. So they have their own strength and fitness guy. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel that it may have been because of what they were doing with these guys as opposed to what you wanted to do with
That's
them?
That's a good question.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Did you ever think about that?
Early in my career, I did. Uh-huh. But, you know, I got to say, as you know, after my first year, I got a lot of the guys to train with me. They weren't training with other guys outside.
I did see that.
Yeah.
I did see that.
So my first year, you know, a guy like Jeter had his own guy. Jorge had his own guy.
Right.
And then, you know, I built the trust. I built, most importantly before trust, just a relationship. And, you know, from that point on, they started to work with me. I mean, I'd go to Miami. I'd work with Alex. Right. I'd work with Jorge, all those guys in the offseason. So there wasn't much of that.
But these guys would... They would bring their fitness guys to the stadium.
Yeah.
How was that? Was there ever like a face-off?
Yeah, no. You know what? We all got along for the most part.
But you know,
Dana, it's like the Tom Brady thing. I mean, look at the whole thing with Tom. He created total separation. And last year it was Belichick. This is what they say. You know, we don't know what's the truth and what's not. You know, that's why we got writers to do some homework, you know, do detective work. But supposedly Belichick threw the guy off the sideline, off the plane, and he was with them for years. And Tom and him built a very, very strong business, correct?
Well, listen, I'll tell you this. If the roles were reversed and I was that guy having to show up at the stadium, I would feel very uncomfortable.
Right.
I just feel like that's not the right thing to do. And I'd say, listen, if I'm going to work with you, it's got to be private, away from the field. Once you get to the field, I don't exist. That's what I would create, because it's not fair to the person that holds that position. And I don't want to get pulled in. Let's say there are a bunch of injuries. Now I'm the outside guy getting pulled into an internal problem. I don't want that either.
So now, one second, Negroni, you wouldn't... Yeah, asked him like 10 questions. Yeah, you know, yeah, I got to ask a couple. But my thought is, if I got my own guy and you're the team guy, shouldn't you be talking to my guy and we all be on the same team? Because it's interesting how, you know, if I'm bringing my guy in the off season and then I got you during the season, and I liked how you said like you would go to Miami and work with Posada and A-Rod. So it seems like you ended up becoming the guy. But wasn't there a relationship with you and their guy in the beginning?
Yeah, there was. I mean, for those guys that lived in colder climates where I didn't want to be in the winter, I would actually have a conversation with the guy. I actually would place a lot of our players with guys that I knew in the industry. And that was my rule. Listen, we just have to openly communicate. Here's what the guy needs. Work on it. You could play a little bit and have a little fun and use your own philosophy, because that's important. You don't want to handcuff somebody. But, you know, don't hurt him. Like, we had an incident with Phil Hughes. He was working at a big place that was well known and had a hamstring injury. One of those years they had him pulling sleds. And it was like, why do you have a pitcher, you know, doing speed training and speed development protocols? It created a problem. So I had to navigate both our front office, our training staff, and that private entity and the player.
That was the question I was going
to
ask.
And you're kind of working all of that to keep everybody from, you know, killing each other.
Right.
And at the end of the day, saying, listen, let's just get focused on how do we get this player right for April 1st.
Right. I mean, somebody needs to quarterback the whole situation.
So anything performance related, I would tend to be the quarterback. But I was in touch with the guys. I didn't feel threatened. You know, I maybe a little bit when I was first starting off, because I didn't understand the climate and how everything was working and why are these guys here? But I could do the job. And there was a little bit of that. But then I started to understand, you know, what it was and why those guys were there initially. But not later in my
Jim, career. I got to ask you now. You saw how big the whole physical fitness thing and half the time, it was the situation, whereas you may have had to ask questions pertaining to that situation. How did you ever go to Dana? Did you ever have to, like...
Well, I'll tell you, I come at this from a weird standpoint, because I lost years of my life talking to Brian McNamee.
Oh, God. Right.
And I ended up covering that trial and all that stuff. So I come from this back from that era, which was the steal the A-Rod straight, goosey-goosey as it got. And so my question is, like, did they ever put in any rules to keep guys out? Because there was, I remember the whole Alejo thing with Giambi back in the early 2000s, and that was even, like, annoying other players. And so, like, there's a lot of, like, personalities there, not even just with like, workplace issues, which is what you're talking about, but, like, you know, when all of a sudden there's a lot of chefs in the kitchen and you know, anyway, are there rules in place?
Yeah, I want to say, I'm not sure of the exact rule, but I know that there was a rule that the trainers could not be basically in the inner workings of the clubhouse and things like that. So that was the rule.
How upset were you with that?
I mean, listen, I wasn't upset because at the end of the day, it just was saying that they couldn't be in the clubhouse. They couldn't be in our training facility. They had if they were ever going to work with somebody, it actually had to be away from the field.
Oh, okay.
So it was a good thing.
Right, right. For you, it was a good thing.
Yeah, and what happened too was, you know, think about it. It became a little bit of an inconvenience because now the players got to start figuring out. And these guys, they don't want to figure things out. They want it handed to them and scripted and all there, and you just have to do and react and run the play. That's, they're trained that way. You know, an uncoached player is kind of like an untrained dog. They don't know what to do, so they just go nuts.
What I was always curious about with someone in your role, and I don't know if I'm breaking...
No, it's good. It's good.
Okay, because I don't know the rules.
No, it's free for all.
You can ask anything, because I had a couple, too, so don't worry.
It's hard to sit down and like, I got this question.
Yeah.
So, what I'm always curious about with someone in your position is that, you know, players are by nature competitive,
right.
and they're competitive in the sense that, you know, they're a Yankee. They're a Yankee today, but they may be a Red Sox tomorrow. That's just the business of it. So a lot of times, I always sense that they didn't trust the people that was working for the organization. So now you're coming at it with your own guy, but here's someone from the organization. Now they don't question that you have their best interest at heart, but do they tell you everything because they wonder where that information is going? Did they ever worry about that stuff?
I think it's about how you build that relationship. You know, early in my career, my first year, actually, you know, Rob Kakuza, a longtime Yankee clubhouse manager.
Hi, Rob.
Yeah, he said to me, he said, Dana, you know, he pulled me aside one day and he said, listen, I want to tell you that relationships in this game are built outside of the field. So we're going to dinner tonight with the guys. And really, from that point, I got to know the guys on a really much deeper level outside of the field.
Right.
So they said, all right, you're cool to roll with us. And, you know, it's listen, as a coach, you're not supposed to be out at, you know, too many dinners or too many after parties and things like that. But believe it or not, for me, because I was young at the time, I was only 23 years old, it kind of gave me rites of passage to know that, okay, he's not a rat. He's not going to, you know, cause problems and start spreading rumors and, you know.
So. Well, we're here with Dana Cavalier, Habits of a Champion. That can go both ways, because then you can be out with the guys. You become friends with the guys. Then they're going to do stuff in front of you because after they feel comfortable. So it is a thin line. Yeah, you want to go and become friendly with them so they realize you're one of them. On the other hand, I like and respect how you're saying, listen, they all want to be coached. They all need the structure, and you're giving them the structure. So, and in your era, your run, this whole steroid thing, and still today, we don't know who's doing it, what's doing it. And it's unfortunate because anybody who hits 40 homers, you know what I mean, is like, oh, wait a second. You know, how's he hitting 40 homers? So I think that
he's
was 5'2".
How's he doing that?
Right. Yeah, I think that's tough for you. But that is really cool that, you know, at 23 years old, you're in the Yankee clubhouse, man. I mean, that just sounds like a little like you. I mean, when you were younger.
But let me say, well, I had an early mentor.
Yeah, right.
But let me ask you this. Now, you're riding around, you know, part of this magical mystery tour, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys were somewhat like the band on the run. I mean, when you were going from town to town and you're seeing the other strength and fitness guys and all that, because I see you guys get together. Hey, what's going on? I mean, did you feel like the bad butt? I can't say bad words on the show. So.
You can't?
I will say, like,
Jim didn't care. He was ready to say anything. I mean,
you definitely get a little bit of an elitist mentality.
Right.
I mean, you know that.
I saw that. Your wife is in back here and backstage over here. Yes. He thought he was like Cary Grant, okay?
I always say it's like traveling with the Rolling Stones.
Yes,
yeah. Know?
But yeah, I mean, think about the personalities that you're dealing with. You walk into another club house, let's say maybe Oakland, and you don't know anybody over there.
Right.
And you're walking in with your guys. Mm-hmm. You got Jeter, you got A-Rod, you got all these guys. And it's, listen, as again, I start as a young guy. It's a very empowering thing to know you have that kind of horsepower behind you. You know, it's
so Dana, how did the Magical Mystery Tour end? I mean, what happened? How come you're not on tour anymore?
Oh man, you had to bring that up.
Yeah, listen, gotta be in the book,
it's
man.
It's in the book.
It's
in the book. It's in the book. Last chapter.
Last chapter.
No, you know what? Yeah, I always say this. You know, as I was going through my journey, in 2007, that was the end of Joe Torre's era, right? And we all know the achievements that he had during his time. And I think when you're in pro sports, you just have to know that there's always an ending. It's just a matter of when.
So
I accepted that really early. And actually, you know, when I first started, Ray over here, he told me something. He said, you know, make sure you use this gig to do really good things. Hmm. And I felt that in my journey, I was able to get so many experiences and I was able to help a lot of people along the way. And now I can do that even more so. So my contract was up. Team wanted to go a different direction. That's the nature of the business. It's not personal. I still have a very close relationship with Brian Cashman and everybody over there. So it's not weird by any means. And who knows what the future brings, you know?
Let me ask you. You had nice relationships with both managers.
Yeah.
Which was your favorite, Joe?
Oh, man. You know, it's a tough question because, I mean, I loved working out with Girardi, and I loved his intensity.
Right.
I think for me as a person, I related more, you know, coming from an Italian household and background to the old school godfather nurturing of a Joe Torre, you know.
So that means you have to kiss his butt a lot.
No. I just, you know what it was? I love the things that he used to do for us, like as a staff. You know, when we were on the road, he'd always take us out to dinner. He'd pull out his own bottles of wine. We'd play games around the table. It was very, like, very family-oriented. And Girardi had different ways of expressing his self and bringing the management together or the leaders of the team together. But both were great, but two totally different styles. So.
Who did you like working for the best?
Oh, man. All tough questions.
Shouldn't have came on the show, man.
Yeah. No, you know what? I think I have a really special allegiance, we'll say, to like a Joe Torre because I was 19 when I first started.
Right.
And he really told me the road.
He started as the assistant to the other guy.
The assistant to the assistant?
Yeah, right. To the assistant. Yeah, so I started really young. And again, I grew up watching these guys on television.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just 2 years. So here I am now. You know, Joe Torre asked me at that age, hey, can you train me? So here I am. One of my spring training assignments is to train Joe Torre. It's like an amazing thing. So I got to know him and he got to know me. And
so he trusted you.
He trusted me and he would do little things that showed you that along the way.
Joe didn't trust a lot of people.
Yeah.
Okay. Per se. So if he trusted you, that means you were in. He didn't trust me.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
I was, to him, I was the pipeline to
you
the boss.
You were George's boy. Yeah. I could see that. Yeah. I wouldn't trust
so
you
he
either.
He didn't trust me.
Right.
I had a difficult time hanging out in that clubhouse when Joe was there because he always gave you this.
Yeah. Smug look. Yeah.
And I said, well, what's he looking at? What's he staring at me for?
We used to have a joke in the press box. We talk about Joe Torre with trust and how he dealt with relievers whenever he would go take a reliever out. Because obviously, you have to trust. If you trust anybody, it's a relief pitcher. And when he would take a relief pitcher out, he would always walk up, and almost always, 95% of the time, he would give him the pat on the back. And then if he really was happy with that reliever, he would give him a clap and then the pat on the back.
Oh, you got
and
that.
And then if he was totally dismayed by it, I mean, I'll never forget Felix Rodriguez throwing just ball after ball after ball, and he doesn't even look him in the eye. And he just looks at him, takes the ball, and that was it. That was
that was the kiss of death.
Done.
Out of there.
Wasn't that one of the things that everyone talked about, his management of the pen?
Oh, yeah.
You know? Well, I love it when I talk to the manager of the pen. And listen, I'm sure there's plenty of situations where you're like, I can't believe you did that. And it could be right. But at the end of the day, the guy won four World Series. I don't see how you could really...
Yeah, but you could have managed that team.
Yeah, it's easy. Okay. That's what everybody said. They said it about Phil Jackson, too.
Mrs. Cavalier could have managed that team. Okay?
They said it about Phil Jackson, too. I mean, come on. Yeah, you need the horses. Yeah, you need the talent. But I'm sure you can go back and look at teams with a lot of talent and write about how did they lose and or how did they not win.
I always thought that you're right. I mean, he walked into an amazing situation, and a lot of people could have done the same thing, although he had to manage Steinbrenner, especially in the early years. That being said, the relief thing, I always thought was a bad knock on him. Like, it wasn't legit in the sense that, because you look at people, you know, random people.
I didn't know Proctor. You were a Tory guy.
I'm neither.
He's a reality guy.
I'm not for or against, but I always thought that was not a good knock on him, because you look at someone like Scott Proctor or Tanyon Sturts, first two, they didn't have those years with another guy. And yes, you might say, okay, they didn't have it afterwards, and they were burnt out. But you know what? They had it with him. So, I mean, how do you argue against that?
Jim, I got to ask you. You started before the era of full-time strength and fitness coaches.
My first year on the Yankee team was 04.
Okay, and so we didn't have that yet.
Okay.
You know what? He had just started. Yeah. We had this fat guy. Who was doing it? I can't remember.
He's Jeff
the guy with glasses.
Yes.
Remember Jeff the guy Mangold, with glasses, yes. though? Before yeah. Jeff, we had this chubby guy. Okay.
So what does a chubby guy do? You just, whatever he says, you do the opposite?
He sells hot dogs.
Jeff Mangold, whose claim to fame was he got the Piazza bat, right? The start of the bat, and sold it on the auction. But yeah, no, you're right.
Oh, really? Wasn't Charlie that guy who stole everything from the Mets? Charlie Samuels, was that his name?
Yeah, who's now banned for life from going to a Mets game.
He should be banned for everything.
How do you ban somebody? Like, if you buy a ticket, they're going to be like, oh, that's Charlie Samuels.
Yeah, really. His face, right, to put his face, photo of him at every gate. Yeah, exactly.
They did the same thing in Boston when the guy almost punched Sheffield. Or remember there was that... it was like a crazy game. That was the game when A-Rod's like saved the kid on the street.
Oh, yeah, that's
crazy
right.
stuff going on that day.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a ball in, long story going longer, but Sheffield almost got into it with a fan in the stands. And I remember the next day the Red Sox said, oh, we're banning this fan from the stadium. How are you going to enforce that,
Yeah.
But anyway.
Quick question, because you brought him up. Sheffy belong in the hole?
He's got the numbers.
I think
it,
so.
It shouldn't be, if that's going to be based on steroids, how do you argue that one, his thing was he worked out with Bonds and the Balco thing, and he put this cream on his body, and I believe Sheffield on that story. Sheffield was one of my favorite ones to talk to, because you never knew what he was.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Always.
Right.
Right. I got to ask you, in going through the book, a lot of psychological stuff. How big is that in this?
Huge.
Tell me.
Yeah, that's huge. For me, I always said, if you're going to be able to work on players, and I did a lot more than the strength and just the conditioning. I did a lot of, soft tissue work, the stretching, the massage, all that kind of stuff. So think about it. In order to do that to somebody, especially these high-level guys, they don't just let anybody in to do that kind of stuff. So you have to, it goes back to earning the trust. So a lot of my game is how do you kind of get in their head and kind of work with them and align with them, and so you can be that positive support, because the teams, they do have sports psychologists, but if you think about it, I always thought about this, and I know the players did too. You have this sports psych guy, right? That's that you're gonna go tell all your problems to. Well, who hires that guy? Right? Typically the organization, the GM. So they're going to want to know, all right, who's medicated, who needs what. So, I know that there's, rules to that as to what can be said. But if the GM is going to ask you what's going on, you're going to tell them.
You want to keep your job.
If you want to keep your job, it's just the way it works. So a lot of players, I was really big on, going to breakfast with a guy, taking him to lunch, but we would have great talks. you know, and to get inside of the head of Mariano Rivera, to get inside of the head of Andy Pettit, I mean, that's a special place to be.
Dana, where are we with women in training? You know, today, and I'm a firm believer, listen, I think I don't really care. If you can do the job, you're in. What I'm not into is just like here in New York with the firefighters. Like, you know, they'll knock the test down. To me, that's bullshit. Okay, if you can't do the job, you don't do the job. You could do the job, you should have the job. Yeah. So in today's day, because you're talking about, you know, training and in the locker room, where are we with women being able to get equal opportunity to do the same job?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, and you know, I never really spoke about this publicly, and Jim, I'm sure you can maybe relate to this in some way, but you know, early in my career, there weren't a lot of women in the clubhouse, and I gotta say, like, you know, I found it to be very interesting when you have guys changing, and you got women staring at them, even though that they're supposed to be there or allowed to be there. I know it made some guys feel uncomfortable.
Did it make you feel uncomfortable?
I didn't change around them that much, but it didn't make me feel that uncomfortable. But I can see it rattling some guys. I mean, you have some guys that are, you know, again, more on the religious side. And I know that made them feel uncomfortable. But other than that, I don't really have that big of an issue with it. Again, I come from whether it's business or whether it's sport. If you're qualified to do the job and you're really good at it and you earn the spot, it's yours. I mean, you could be, it doesn't matter. Male, female, black, white, Asian, whatever you are, it doesn't matter. If you are qualified and better than the person next to you, you should have the job.
So are there women in the training world?
No. Right. Not that I've seen. I know,
you know, when you bring it back, thinking about Jim, and I love how everyone's in love with Strahan. He's the greatest thing in the world, because we all realize Tiki had the first shot to be what Strahan's doing, and Tiki blew it for whatever reason. But let's not forget how Strahan treated that girl. That woman reporter, you know, you remember this, Jim? He just totally disrespected her. I forget her name. I think her name was Lisa. I don't remember her last name. But Stray was not cool at all in that giant locker room to that woman when she came in. And I think it could have been more than once. I mean, I don't have all my facts, but I know that Stray was not nice to that girl at all.
He actually had a reputation for being abrasive, period. And the many reporters from that era are stunned that he became who he is, just because this was not, you know, predictable for him. But I will say, in terms of the clubhouse, that was the thing I hated the most about the job, was because I didn't want to be there either.
It's awkward, yeah, right? Everyone's standing there like, you know, all right, what do I do with my hands? You know,
and like 90 whatever percent of the time, I'm there because everyone else is there.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, you're playing defense, you know, as if like a fire is going to break out or something like that.
Right.
You know? And it was just the epitome of like, I'm doing this because everyone says I have to be doing this, so I'm going to stand here and do nothing. And I remember it got somewhat better later on, but like 04, 05, I didn't have a phone. You know, I had a cell phone that was like, you know, I don't even know if I texted on it. So you just really were standing there, you know. At least now you have an iPhone or whatever. I think I got BlackBerry.
You didn't have those recorder things?
Oh, yeah. But, like, I mean, you know, I'm just talking about, like, passing the time.
Oh, yeah. And I always thought it would have been better to just move everyone into, like, now there's a whole room for media.
Right.
Yeah. Just funnel the players. Hey, listen, it's your obligation. So that way the media doesn't have to worry about missing anybody. It's saying, hey, who do you guys want to see tonight? And they all go in that room. They do what they have to do. And nobody's uncomfortable.
You know, Jim, my problem in today's game is I get that some guys don't speak the language. And I've told this to Negroni. Okay, so I'm cool.
Why you got to point me out in front of everyone?
Why not? You're on the show.
I don't need an interpreter.
You're the host. So, you know, you have these guys. And Spanish guys, Japanese guys, whatever they are. Okay?
What about the Jewish guys?
We speak English. Oh. So you hire an interpreter. Which the funniest thing to me is when you got Sanchez and then you got the Japanese guy on the mound. I don't know what's going on there, but that's just a joke. But it's, I don't like that they get away with not having to talk to the media. They really do. I mean, you know, look at Cespedes. I mean, never talks to the media. He's your main guy. I don't talk to anybody. And then second to me, I'd say, listen, I got no problem with giving you an interpreter. You got a year. You got to learn language. You got to come back next year at spring training.
Like Leibar Torres.
You got to learn how to speak, man. This isn't right.
Yeah, I agree.
You know who agrees with you? Mariano Rivera.
Yeah. 100% I agree. No,
He used to get mad at Jose Contreras. Now I'm dating myself with these stories. But, right. He would get mad at him for not learning English.
I totally agree.
You know, it's funny. I did something with Glaber, and he came, and Glaber, very, very smart, because he had asked Negroni to, you know, if stand he needed close. Him, stand close if he needed him. And he really didn't. He's very, very good. And he told me, he said, when I was 18 years old, I said to myself, you know something? And he's thinking marketing. I mean, think about it. He's 18 years old. And he goes, you know something? I better learn English because, you know, if I'm going to play baseball, professional baseball, I need to learn English. I need to do some marketing. I need to figure out this language to do my business.
Talking about marketing, number one, the book, good for young adults, from what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
It talks about bullying.
Yep.
Okay, and why did you decide to put that in this book?
So I actually have a gentleman that I work with. He's a part owner of the Dodgers now. Okay. He's with Guggenheim, a capital, private equity group. And I grew up in Argentina, and there's a story about it. And it talks about bullying. And he said whenever he would move to a new school, the first thing he would do is he'd find the biggest bully there, and he'd pop him in the face. And
wow.
And
sounds like you.
Yeah, just to establish himself. But it goes deeper, and the book breaks it down as like a bully is really symbolic of fear, because everybody's got fear or something that they're afraid of. So instead of running, go right towards it, pop it, and all of a sudden now you're starting to groove. So it's I use different stories throughout the book.
And why is it the Nolan Ryan Award? I mean, I could see you're going to get a strength and conditioning award. I get it. To me, I would find a guy. If we're going to name
like
it after
Arnold
next
Schwarzenegger one.
Exactly, man. I got to get a guy. I mean, I look at Nolan. I get it. You know, he's still pitching, probably getting people out.
Yeah.
But I would look for like a guy who's like all built and strength and all that kind of stuff. So how does Nolan Ryan get that award named after him?
The symbol of endurance and the symbol of strength and power. And I want to say he was one of the early adopters of training.
Yes. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Because you look in football, you know, and you go back, Walter Payton was considered ridiculous, the training methods he did. And a good buddy of mine, the GOAT, Jerry Rice, another one. You know, these guys were running up the mountains, going to the stadium, running up and down. I mean, like crazy stuff.
You know, it brings up a whole nother just another direction, but you know, there's a lot of talk as to what the value add really is to a strength program at the professional level in baseball specifically. I had a great talk years ago with Ichiro Suzuki, and he made a great point. He said
in English. Okay.
When I first
Jim, just checking, making sure.
Yeah, when he first came here from Japan, you know, they got him an American training program. He got bigger, he got stronger, and he got worse. He said he felt achy and he had pains and he felt like his injury risk was much higher. So then he went back to Japan and started using all these different methods, special machines and just movement oriented. Right.
You know, a lot of the Yankees told me, and you guys would know better than me, in batting practice, he would hit bombs.
One after the
like
next,
that guy really could have been a 3-4-5 hitter and he let off and did it. But I heard he hit bombs. You know, right here, our boy who played Reggie, and we haven't even spoke to him yet because I know he's very busy. He works out. If you look at him, this guy works out. I mean, I don't know what you can do for him, but this guy's in shape, right? I mean, you're working out.
Yeah, I try to do the best I can.
You're doing a pretty good job the best you can.
Let me just ask you this. How much?
Oh.
How much what?
The book.
So, $19.99.
Okay. I see on the back of the book my old boy, Brandon Steiner. Okay, now I've seen Steiner. Okay, I know Steiner a long time. And that boy don't look in shape.
I am not going to spend 1 minute talking about Steiner. Steiner's got his own network.
He's got his own platform.
Yeah, no one's listening.
You don't need it. Brandon, see you later. But anyway, with that being said, do me a favor. This is a very fine actor over here. Would you give him your Reggie imitation? Listen to this.
You're putting me on the spot. That's the hardest part. I heard you played me in a play recently. Did you tell them how great we are? How special we are? How if we were still playing at A, we'd be all Hall of Famers, MVPs. We'd be making millions.
I love it. I love it.
I'm a little rusty. It's been a while.
What did you do to become Reggie? Huh? YouTube. How did you become Reggie?
YouTube, and I just got into character, man. It's, I know I had big shoes to fill, but God knows I gave it my all, man. It's just the cast. It's like family. And one day, Ray texts me, and I'm looking at my text. I'm like, what is he saying? He sent me a picture of Reggie Jackson. And underneath it, it said, I want to thank you for playing me so well. And I looked at my phone. I had to take a double take. I'm like, is this for? I'm like, wow.
And Reggie.
Little tears came to my eyes, man. So it's, oh, wow.
Okay, so let me ask you. I want you to sit next to Dana. Would you guys switch for me? Okay. We'll just sit next to Dana. Because I want to send this to Reggie. Okay, I want to make sure that Reggie watches this. Okay, now, there was a scene in the play where as Thurman Munson dies, and we're in the clubhouse, and Reggie had to cry. And I want you to give our audience, you've just been told Thurman has died. George Steinbrenner is telling everybody how he died, and all of a sudden he breaks up, and then Reggie breaks down. Give it to us.
Did you like practice in the car in front of a mirror, like in the shower? What were you doing?
He was beaten by his girlfriend.
It was a good time, man. I love the cast. Like I said, it's like family, man. And Ray is my hero. It's like Robbie Drummondhouser introducing me to Ray for the second time at my job. I'm working. And every time I would see Robbie, I was like, listen, I know you're telling me about your son. He's doing this. Anytime you get an opening, if you need anything. And then he introduced me to Ray for the second time. Because Ray came to my job about 4 years ago and gave like a motivational speech. And
he did?
Yeah. It was like a speech about him coming up and how he became the bat boy for the Yankees. And everybody in the room was like, wow.
How many cars were sold that day after he
about
left?
About 15.
Because I know my boy Brownie, that's what he wants to know.
I'm big on motivation. Right. And I'm big on giving back. And just for the play, like,
now how did
it's amazing.
Did I put you on the spot?
Me on the spot in the office. He told me, I'm going to say verbatim. He said, Reggie's kind of light-skinned. You're kind of dark. Reggie. I got the build and stuff. I want to see you cry like a bitch. I said, oh man,
Negroni
didn't say, hey, let me get you some of that Michael Jackson cream or something, and, you know, lighten up a little.
He gave me a shot.
Jim, you like that one?
You either get a guy that looks like Reggie who can't act, right, or a guy that can act but doesn't
great.
Look like Reggie, you know. And it was like, you know, that's the first thing that Reggie says to me. He goes, that MFR don't look like me. You know what I mean? Here we go. I knew it. Here we go. And then, you know what? And I didn't want to invite Reggie. Reggie, I didn't want to invite you to the play because you would have said, that didn't happen. I never got mad at Billy. Anyway, you know, I just, that's why.
Quiet in the seats.
And the funny thing about it, I'm a firm believer of everything happens for a reason. That fight that Billy Martin and I had in the dugout at Fenway Park, that happened on my birthday, June 18th. So how crazy is that? And that's my favorite part of the scene, where I let Billy have it for taking me out of the game.
And you let him have it, man. That was great.
It was my birthday.
You know, they do have a photo of that. Yeah. And I'll tell you a quick story only because we have a few minutes. I don't want to bring up someone's name where I used to work for many, many years because we're not allowed to use his name. But, so I did many appearances with Reggie. And so we found this photo of him in the dugout, black and white, in their face of each other. So when Reggie would sign autographs, you know, we did a tremendous Reggie Jackson autograph business. So what I told my guys was, I found this photo. Somebody found the photo. I said, print up like 25. Just put them in the stack. Okay? Throw them in the stack. And again, you know, in the autograph business, Reggie had many moments to be able to sell. And so we put them in the stack. We're knocking them out. And Reggie's doing it. And all of a sudden, here's this photo. Reggie stops, looks at the photo, and I'm saying to myself,
uh-oh.
He's going to blow these. I'm going to play stupid. It didn't really matter. I know I'm cool. I don't know. And Reggie looks, and he looks at me, and he goes, you know about this? And I figured he's going to go, you know about the photos being in there? I go, yeah, I heard about it, Reggie. I was a kid. I really don't know much about it. And then Reggie starts signing those photos and starts putting stuff on there. Like, I would have knocked you out. I would hit you. I mean, I couldn't believe the gold in business, what he was doing. And I immediately sold a couple of those to some very good customers who I know would think these are one-ofs, because in the autograph business, you want stuff that's totally different, one-ofs, and then put them on our website, and they went for some nice money. And as a matter of fact, I did find one that I do have in my house that
Reggie signed. I want to see it.
Yeah, I got to find it. I did see it. Yeah.
Please, I want to see that.
That was very interesting. I got to bring that up to Reggie when I see him. Mm-hmm. But that was interesting that we did find that photo in the dugout of that fight.
And then another thing, not to cut you off.
No, you can cut me off. It's only in the Brony show.
The book I read, Yankee Miracles, when Ray gave me
the book. Who wrote that?
Who wrote it?
Who wrote that, yeah.
I don't know who wrote it.
You don't know who wrote
it. I read
it. Okay.
But it's a great book. Yeah. Great book. Don't know who wrote it, by the way.
I don't know. I'm asking you. You read it. I didn't read it.
Just read it. Very good book. Yankee Miracles.
Very nice. So you like the book?
Love the book.
Okay,
so you picked up insight that you used in the play?
100%.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
How I got in the character every time.
And he was money, YouTube, man. You were money.
Watching YouTube. And it's just like the cast. Everybody around, it's like family. We critique each other. It's, like I said, it's just like family.
Well,
And the big thing is about giving back. So that's the reason why.
No, that was big. That was big for us.
I would think that if you're playing Reggie Jackson, you could probably get a lot of content if you watched like Apollo Creed when he was coming out to fight Rocky in those American flag shorts.
Yeah, yeah, no question about it. Well, it's been a great show.
It's over already.
Well, you were half hour late, so you know. But I just want to say, for $20. You can pick up a terrific book to learn about the world champion Yankees of 2009. And at the same time, it's a book that your kids can read. Have your kids been bullied? Or to prevent the bullying aspect of what kids go through. I have three sons. And I'm grateful that, in essence, only one dealt with that whole bullying thing. And he ended up fighting. He ended up becoming a boxer just to get out of that thing out of his brain. You know, I wish he didn't. But you know what, Dana, I thank you very much for writing this book. As a dad, I say that to you. And as a dad, I say go and pick this book up for your kids. As a fan, or if you want to get in shape and you can't afford Dana Cavalier in the gym, then get Dana Cavalier in the book. You hear what I'm saying? You could use a couple of pounds off right
Dana,
there.
You don't have like the video? Like everyone has a video, like the Jane Fonda video?
Yeah, I'm working on that.
And Jim, where does everyone get to read? I mean, you're such a great writer. How does everybody find you?
Newsday, every day, you know, newsday.com.
Now, you're writing more than just baseball now.
Yeah, I'm the sports writer who does not cover sports. I'm doing anything off the field.
I see you all over the place.
What's your take on the DeGrom, Cy Young, and all that stuff? Would you have voted for him for the Cy Young?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a best pitcher award. You know, and was he the best pitcher? He was the best pitcher. So why would you?
What about the guy in San Diego? What do you think of that guy just, going with Scherzer?
Oh, yeah, you know what? I don't have a problem. My problem goes back to... Why are writers the ones voting for it?
I agree with that. I thought the whole thing on WFAN with the schmoozer with Steve Summers, listen, you got to respect the guy. He's on the radio for 30, 40 years, but I thought he handled it wrong. You know, you were fortunate to get the guy to come on your airwaves. I don't know where else the guy was in the country. Anybody involved in baseball wanted to hear what he was thinking, and you blew the guy off. Basically, you didn't give it a chance to explain what his thought process was.
And that's fair. The one thing, and I'll give the writer credit, because in that scenario, you want to be accountable. You have to be accountable.
Yeah.
I remember when I did vote for awards my first 3 years on the beat until I decided against it. In my first year, in 04, I voted for Rookie of the Year. And I looked at the numbers, and I voted for this 30-some-year-old reliever from Chicago, Shingo Takatsu, I believe his name was. Ended up doing very little in his career after that. But I thought he had the best career, best year of any rookie. And it ended up being won by Bobby Crosby, this Oakland shortstop. Right. And he won it with all but one first place vote, which was mine. And I remember when the vote came out, I was like, oh, I didn't think I was making that controversial a pick. And I got a call from a writer from, Oakland. Wondering why I didn't vote. And I explained. And they said, was this retribution for the previous year? I guess Matsui did not win the Rookie of the Year, and people held it against him that, you know, he was a rookie, but he was the best Japanese player coming over at that time. It's a retribution, you know. But at the same time, like, I thought it was asinine to be asked that, but at the same time, you got to be accountable.
But, you think about it, you're right, being a writer, and that's what happens. You know, they're going to say to you, why are you voting for him? You're a writer, and you're like, you shouldn't be doing it, which I agree. And then you're like, well,
yeah,
maybe it's because of this. You know, you were comfortable. You met the guy. You liked the guy, like the DeGrom people. You know, and what New York writer wasn't going to vote for DeGrom? Whether or not you look at Scherzer's numbers, Scherzer had a great year. I mean, it just was that ERA of one full run. Otherwise, Scherzer's year was, again, dominant. And one last thing, just because we're talking about Scherzer. If you go down in baseball and look about who's earned their contracts, Scherzer has to be right up there as one of the top 10 guys who's earned every dollar of his ridiculously huge salary.
Which is rare for a free agent pitcher.
Tyrell, do we see you again in Bat Boy?
Absolutely.
Dana, next book?
Coming soon.
How do the fans get a hold of you?
DanaCavalier.com, Dana Cavalier on Twitter, and start there. It's the best way.
Jim, how do the fans get a hold of you?
Yeah, I mean, Jim Ballenbeck on my Twitter account, but Newsday. Just keep going to Newsday. They've employed me for 20 years. I'm rooting for 20 more. So,
Jim, are you a responder? Like, if someone's going after you, Twitter or emailing you, whatever,
you're
going back at them?
Definitely, yeah.
Love it, man.
You may be running from people, but anyway.
I don't run, man.
Well, we'll try it again next week and see if you run over here, okay?
Same bat time,
same
bat channel.
Bat station.
That's it. I got to say something before we leave. For the record, my name is Tyrell. Only Ray can call me Tyrell. That's it.
Well, is there another athlete
Latino,
who did that?
I can't help it. That's how we say Tyrell. You know what I'm saying?
What other athlete did to say the same thing, that they were calling the wrong
Tyrell.
Name?
Tyrell. Tyrell. Tyrell.
Right.
Terrell.
That's it.
All right. See you guys next week. Thank you so much for reaching out.
man has already won. Oh, my mind is all I share.